hearts of love we meet for the world anew.
Welcome to Muffin Talk. And welcome to Muffin Talk. Muffin Talk is a weekly radio program to which I invite guests to talk about their work and their passion for issues on community programs, social justice, Bible studies, or the Catholic Church. Today I've invited Brother Kieran Finn to a Zoom recording for broadcast. Brother Kieran, a warm welcome and hi to the radio program.
Yor bayatai.
Brother Kieran Finn is a Champagnat brother and Bible scholar. He is originally from Gisborne and has spent many years in adult education, teaching scripture in New Zealand, abroad, and online with Titi Bonamo Study and Joy. We are pleased to let you know that we have another Bible course coming up with Brother Kieran, and this time we will look at the Gospel of Mark. The Gospel of Mark will be the gospel for the next church year, and the new church year starts with the first of Advent. Brother Kieran, the setting of this gospel is both history and text. What is there to look at in both?
Well, I think we have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And the big question is, why is Matthew listed first? And I'll say, well, in the early church, Matthew certainly was the most used and probably the most important of the gospels. But what happened to Mark was that in the 5th century, we have Augustine saying it's a summary gospel. It's just a summary of Matthew and of Luke. And it's survival. I think the fact that we had to have four gospels was Mark got there and it got left there as the summary. And it took 1,400 years till we reached the 19th century, and we started to look at the synoptic gospels, where you list each of the three gospels in a gospel parallel. And it was then that it was realized that no, the earliest gospel is Mark.
So we got it all wrong. We got it all wrong. We're saying that the year A is Matthew. We should have Mark as the year of A.
Well, perhaps if we give it, well, we can't assign Luke to third place, really, can we? But the thing about the Gospel of Mark, it needs to be understood much better because it's the scariest, it's the most demanding, it's the most neglected of the Gospels, and its portrayal is an embarrassment to any institution because the portrayal of the leaders of the church, of the disciples, is embarrassing. But Mark's gospel hung in because there's an association with Peter and an association with Rome, so you can't let that little fellow slip out.
Brother Kieran, you say the little fellow, is that why Augustine thought it is a summary, because it's the shortest one?
Because everything that you find in Mark is actually found in Matthew, and a lot of it is in Luke. Because, you see, it became the central gospel. It, more than 90% of the Gospel of Mark is contained in Matthew. And the point is, each gospel, they use their material to shape a particular presentation of the person of Jesus. So, yes, I think that's some of the important historical issues tied up with it.
So, but, yeah?
Yes, go on, yes.
So how does Mark tell the story? Is it a different way of telling the story to the synoptic gospels, for example, the ones that are very close?
Yeah. Well, the first thing you notice when you go to Mark is there's no infancy narrative, no Christmas stories. I personally think that the question hasn't been asked yet, if this is the earliest of the Gospels. The question hasn't arisen yet, what was he like as a child? So there's still about 15 or more years to go before we reach that point. But again, I think each gospel tells its own story in its own way. And the way that I think, but to be fair to Mark, there is an amazing reaching back into the history of Israel, just as infancy narratives themselves have got sort of introduction, but also reaching back. So take Matthew and how much that reaches back into the Exodus story. But what do we have in Mark? We start with John the Baptist, who wears the clothing of the prophet Elijah. We have him at the River Jordan, and the crossing of the River Jordan under Joshua opened the land up, the promised land to the people. Then we have the desert. Jesus is driven out, thrown out into the desert for the temptations. And the desert was the place of the crossing, the place where they lived for the 40 years. So there's, again, that input. And the sea, the stories of storm at sea and the walking on the water, the parting of the Red Sea, the Yam Suf, there's that evoked. And then, of course, the stilling of the storm, yes. And then the mountains, the Mount of the Transfiguration. See, all of these evocative settings are doing the work that the infancy narratives do, reaching back to reach into the present, to reach forward.
And do we know anything about where Mark came from?
But possibly, I'm more and more inclined to move towards Rome, Gentile territory, and occasionally northern Syria. It's always very difficult to work out, but from the nature of the gospel, and remember, what happened originally was that story, the story of Jesus was told in the context of a meal, the oral tradition, and somewhere along the line after the telling of the story, it gets written down. So I would say that the Gentile issue is an important one. It's fascinating how in this gospel with the Sea of Galilee, what happens on one side happens on the other. Jew, Gentile. And you can think of so many examples. The feeding of the 5,000, the gathering up of the 12 baskets, the feeding of the 4,000, gathering up of the 7 baskets. And again and again, a healing, the Syrophoenician woman, her daughter to be healed. Then the healing of Jairus' daughter on the Jewish side. Jewish, Gentile, stormy crossing, because the challenge of the Gentile mission in that first century must have been a real headache and a real challenge. And the stormy crossing, I think, is a wonderful symbol of the stormy acceptance of Gentiles into the church in the early days.
Wasn't that a time where there were also a lot of persecution of Christians?
Precisely. So that brings us to the question of the setting for the gospel. And I think it's really interesting when you start to look at things like setting, characters, the literary analysis of a gospel, looking at plot, character, and so on, it makes us realize that it's not just a biography, someone sitting down and writing everything as it happened. That's why I'm so insistent on the three stages of the gospel, of how you have the time of the life of Jesus, you have the resurrection, you have the oral tradition, the telling of the Jesus story, and then you have the evangelist shaping the presentation of Jesus in a particular way to bring to the audience a message of encouragement, a message of a presentation of Jesus. And your point is a really interesting one, because we have the year 70, or round about that when the gospel was written, two enormous catastrophic events: the persecution by Nero in the year 64, the Christians taken to the Circus Maximus. Then, of course, you have the
destruction of the temple.
Destruction of Jerusalem. Yes, you see, this is the background to all of this. A terrible time of crisis and suffering. A terrible time of betrayal of Christians of one another. I mean, when we look at the passion, we can see betrayal right, left, and center. We had what happened if your knocking came on the door of the Roman soldiers looking for Christians, then you had to say you weren't a Christian, curse Jesus, and of course, what does Peter do when he's confronted? Calls down a curse, and then betray any fellow Christian. This is the environment. Fed to the hungry dogs, if you were a Christian. You died for your faith. So what sort of presentation of Jesus does this gospel give? Ultimately, through the cross to resurrection. That is the most important portrayal in this gospel, and it is a very interesting one in terms of the development. Because if we take the very first verse, the beginning of the good news, the gospel, the good news, the gospel, of Jesus the Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Son of God. What do those terms mean? Good news, Messiah, Son of God. How were those things understood in that world? Certainly, how can it be good news when it ends in the devastating death of the Anointed One, the Messiah, and the Son of God? Look, we've got that in verse 1. We are told what the gospel is really about. That Jesus is the Son of God. We have that title, Son of God, is fascinating because it's the highest of the titles, obviously, but it's got to be understood that in the Jewish world, a Son of God was one anointed by God who carries out God's will. Kings and prophets were Son of God. In the Roman world, of course, we have all those legends and stories where the Son of God was a god. So we have interesting use in the Gospel of Mark of this title, Son of God, where we're told the secret. Talk about dramatic irony. We know the big secret. But the next time we hear that Son of God, it's when the heavens are torn open. Example. That's that same term is used when the curtain veil is torn at the end when Jesus dies. But that first time, you are my son, my beloved son. Jesus hears that. Nobody else does.
Is that during the baptism?
That's the baptism by John. Yes. And
it's different to the other gospels where it says, this is my son.
Sure, because there's no longer need to keep the messianic secret.
So what is the messianic secret?
Well, the messianic secret is how on earth is this Jesus going to be the Messiah? How is he going to show himself as Son of God? Because remember, the next time we hear, this is my beloved son, listen to him, is when? At the mountain transfiguration? Right. And of course, we have those disciples, the three who are with him, Jesus. And then we move on. The thing is, nobody has got this. What type of Messiah Jesus is going to be? Now, we get a faint glimmer with Peter. Who do people say that I am? Then we get a strong picture when that wonderful woman anoints Jesus for his burial.
Mm-hmm.
She seems to have some awareness of what type of Messiah he's going to be. And then, amazingly, the last person that you would expect to recognize truly this was God's son. Who was that?
Is that at the cross, the Roman soldier, isn't it?
The same one who just killed him, executed him. Yes, and he's a Gentile.
So you know, when you look at it closely with these three examples that you brought, Peter has called down a curse. So he's not the perfect follower in a way. You can say that the woman saw something that the natural follower in a patriarchal, the natural leaders in a patriarchal system would not see as a leader. She recognized him, and then a Gentile. So where are all those who are supposed to know it all? How come that they don't recognize Jesus so quickly?
I'm pleased you put that, because I always like to say, for the love of God, if you're going to be teaching the Gospel of Mark, use the line, I think it came from one of the great Australian scholars, Jesus never fails failing disciples. Pope Francis has just said that theology has got to be pastoral, related to the lives of people. And with this Gospel of Mark, the failure, the tragic failure of the disciples, images of blindness, images of paralysis, images of deafness, are associated with this, the way the gospel is written. We have 8 chapters of a Jesus in power, but you can't have a Messiah who is the Messiah in power. Then you get 8 chapters of a Jesus in weakness. But there are 2 chapters between 8 and 10. Starting off with that weird story of the blind man of Bethsaida. And there's something very interesting about that. This is the one about, can you see? Oh, it looks like trees walking. What's so fascinating about that blindness story is that Jesus doesn't get it right first time. It takes 2 efforts to heal that blindness. And that, you know, that sort of story, those sort of things, the other Gospels are they're withdrawn from those things. Because in the Gospel of Mark, Jesus is the most human in Mark. He gets angry, he feels disappointment, he expresses it.
So he's Son of God and Son of Man.
Absolutely. And I think the humanity of Jesus in this gospel, he can feel disappointment. I mean, look at what happens. The disciples fail him. His family, his village don't recognize him. And a prophet not honored in his own people. And his family think he's out of his mind and come to get him. So you find this pattern of misunderstanding threading its way through. And then finally you get that heartbreaking line that his disciples all forsook him and fled. Now, I always feel it when we hear the story of the death of John the Baptist, because at the end it says that his disciples came and got the body of John. Where were the disciples of Jesus? And you sort of, this story that begins at chapter 8, starts off promising. And of course, the poor disciples didn't start off promising. They left everything. Remember the first 4? They left everything to follow him. And they followed him immediately.
And
your pace of the gospel, 41 times that word immediately is there.
Oh, so maybe that's why it's so short, because it's fast pace.
It is fast. By somebody once described it as a passion narrative with a long introduction. And I think that's pretty good description of it. Yes. So they set out on the journey. Caesarea Philippi, who do people say that I am? Who do you say that I am? And look, you've got to see that when a rabbi walked along, the disciples followed. And Jesus, for the first time, has on his lips the prediction of his passion and death. And Peter doesn't like that at all as a messianic description. He gets out of his line and comes and stands in front of Jesus and said, "This shall not be so." And what does he get told? "Get behind me. Your thoughts, get behind me, Satan."
Yes.
"You're out of line. Get back and oh dear." So that's not a very promising piece. You are Peter and upon this rock. You've got to go to Matthew for that bit in the same story. Now, that's not a promising beginning. Then they go on. And then Jesus asks, "What were you guys talking about back there on the road?" And they get all embarrassed because they're talking about who was the greatest among them. Just when Jesus takes that little child and places it among them. Good try. This is what you have to be like. Depend on the good goodness of our God, the Abba, the beautiful prayer of Jesus, the Abba. And of course, we don't have the Our Father, but we have a little bit of it in the garden. I'm sure that's what where a lot of this, the account of the garden at the end of the gospel. But we'll find that when we look at the passion narratives. But then we wander on, and then Jimmy and Johnny come along asking for top places on the right and the left, minister of finance and maybe in charge of the army or prime minister or some such like. And can you drink the cup that I can drink? It's such an embarrassing story that Matthew blames it on the mother. And then, of course, finally, we come to Bartimaeus, Jericho, and we have someone who, with faith in Jesus, cries out that he may see. Faithful people are very interesting, you know. The faith of the Gentile woman who wanted a healing for her daughter.
Yes.
Gentile. The faith of the centurion who wanted a healing for her servant. They were great faiths, those two.
It's interesting how everything is like turned upside down. So what do you expect Jesus would do? And first greet the hierarchy, then do this, and then, you know, have this structure. And
yes,
it's people here and there who have not been perfect, and he doesn't come into town on a horse. He comes on a donkey. So he's not coming as a king to rule, but it's a different approach. So that must have been really challenging for people who have been waiting for somebody who will free them of all problems.
Yes. So this raises an interesting question. What do we see when we look at the cross? I know we have all the theology of atonement and taking away the effects of sin, and all right, I accept that. But I look at the cross and I see someone who gave themselves for others completely and utterly in an act of love. It was greater love in John's gospel no one can have than to give one's life for one's friends. And I look at that, and it's a challenge to all of us, because what are our lives meant to be as Christians? The self-giving and love to one another and growing through that love. So the cross speaks many things, especially in this gospel, because it tells us the great message through the cross to the resurrection, I think, is what Mark's gospel ultimately is portraying, through the cross to the resurrection. And that, of course, is the great paradox of the what do we expect of this powerful figure that in the first 8 chapters there are at least 15 miracles. And then but the people don't come to identify him as Son of God because he's a great miracle worker. I mean, it's not right to say that Jesus was God and he proved it by the miracles he worked. That's not what it's about at all. And Mark deflates that. Mark also honestly shows the weakness of leaders, and in our day and age, we have to acknowledge that we have an issue of clericalism, of leadership, and a challenge that Jesus puts before every person in a leadership position.
Thank you very much, Brother Kieran. I think that we hear more from you on Monday. So those listeners who are able to join us next Monday at 7 o'clock, it's on Zoom. And just register with us so that you can get a Zoom link. And this will be a 2-part series on the Gospel of Mark. Both sessions stand alone, but are also connecting. So the 13th and the 20th of November, 7 to 8:30. For more information, registration, and further videos, please see my website at www.studyjoy.nz. So thank you so much, Brother Kieran, for this insight in the Gospel of Mark, and we're looking forward to hearing more on Monday.
Thank you.
Kia kaha, and keep safe.
Out there, old pieces calling, in the bonds of love we meet, for the world a new day dawning, and shine. Of love.